I'm Kimberly, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, there she is. it's an honor to be able to introduce tonight's speaker. I met her about 5 years ago, and she was a hot mess. But I can tell you that today, Marcia is an alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous alcoholic. She works with a sponsor. Sponsors other women, does service work, goes to meetings, and continually tries to improve her spiritual life. And she's been a gift for me. And I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to let Marcia come, because I know she's just chomping at the bit to get up here.
I'm not sure chomping at the bit is what you call it.
Hi, I'm Marcia. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know about talking through this microphone, so can everybody hear me? It's funny, Bruce was reading, and I thought, oh my God, I don't remember my story. I don't remember anything. Everything left all at once. So I'm going to take another moment of silence and invite God in, and then we'll see what he has to say. Okay, I'm Marcia, I'm an alcoholic, I said that. My sobriety date is January 5th, 2009. I had a mother and a father and a brother and grew up in what I thought was just a normal life. My parents had friends over on the weekend, they played cards, they drank. The kids played in the basement. Nothing unusual. Nobody got rip-roaring drunk. There weren't arguments. There weren't the things that I would come to think as normal happening at that time that I would come to think they were normal. My parents divorced when I was 12. It was a shock to me and my brother, and it was a shock to the community. They were very involved in the community. They coached baseball and softball, and it was just a shock. I remember that a couple of weeks before Dad said that he was leaving, I had gotten mad because I couldn't get on the back of a motorcycle with a boy at 12. I was pissed off at him because he wouldn't let me do that, and I had made the comment to one of my friends, I just wish he would leave, you know. And then 2 weeks later, our parents are sitting us down telling us that that Dad's moving out. And I look back at that now, and I think I carried a lot of guilt for a long time. I thought that my dad left because of me. And, I know now that that's not true. It's not true at all. There were lots of problems that I didn't know about for a lot of years. And my mom worked real hard trying to raise us. She did the best that she could. She had kind of lived a sheltered life, and had her father and mother were real strict, and so when she got divorced, she kind of went wild. There were parties at our house every weekend. There was lots of drinking. There was lots of, I remember riding around in the car with her at probably 12, 13 years old, and she was smoking pot with the neighborhood kids that were 17, 18, 19 years old. And I didn't know this wasn't normal. I didn't, it's just how I grew up, you know. I was a good kid. I worked as hard as I could to get the B's and C's. And my brother, he didn't ever have to pick up a book, and he made straight A's. And that always felt like he was the golden child, you know. He always was in mom's good graces, and it didn't matter what he did. And I grew up with a lot of feelings of that I wasn't as good as him. And I was tall, and got asked to play basketball in junior high school. And I was so clumsy, I couldn't do it. I sat the bench the first 2 years, and one time we were, this is funny, I have a nickname today because of this, but we were in practice and I got the ball and I was going for it, and I was doing the pretty full court straight out, and I did the prettiest layup I'd ever done, and I stopped and turned around and everybody was at the other end of the court. Thank God it was practice and I'd gone to the wrong goal. So my brother still calls me wrong way to this day. But you know, I discovered boys, and so basketball wasn't fun. I didn't stick with it. I didn't get through those awkward, uncoordinated years, and I started with the boyfriends, and they were one after the other, for the better part of the rest of my life until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll talk more about that in a minute, but I took my first drink at 12. My mom had a friend over, and they were drinking vodka and orange juice, and they thought it would be fun to give me a drink. And it was in the winter. It was cold outside. And I got drunk. And the craziest thing, I was barefooted in the house, I guess, and they dared me to run around the house. And so I took off running around the house. I was doing laps around the house. It was the dead of winter. I didn't have any shoes on. You know, who knows why they thought that was fun. I guess I would have too, but drunk 12-year-old. But I remember thinking, the point is, I remember thinking that I was invincible, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me the first time. It made me feel invincible. It didn't matter that it was cold. I didn't feel, you know, I could do anything at that moment. And I didn't drink solid from then on out, but the drinking solid all the time probably started, I'm going to guess, probably 9th or 10th grade, whatever that was. I missed my 9th grade, first day of 9th grade, because I had gone to my best friend, had older brothers, and they had a keg party on Saturday night, so on Sunday night we went and drank the rest of the keg, and I was sick. I was so sick. I didn't drink beer throughout the rest of my life, my drinking career, because of how sick I got on beer that night. It never appealed to me after that, but you know, I had just bits of things like that happened, you know, and it just led into more and more and more and more. When I was 18, I got dared to go on a date with this guy that nobody liked. 6 months later, I was living with him. You know, I was 19. He had a 9-year-old daughter that needed somebody to take care of. And he was 10 years older than me, but had told me he was only 8 years older than me. So that made it, you know, that made it okay. So I was 19, he was 29, and we had a 9-year-old, and I had fun. We played dress up. I put makeup on her, she put makeup on me, we played with our hair. I was still a kid, I didn't know what I was doing, you know. Let me back up just a little bit. I didn't graduate high school with my class because I had discovered skipping and drinking. I didn't drink or smoke pot at school, but I did it to where I couldn't go to school, and I would skip. And the principal came in. My mom took me to the principal halfway through my senior year, and he said, "I don't care if you make 100s and straight A's the rest of this year, you're not gonna pass." And all I needed was a half a credit of senior English, so I went to summer school, and I only had to go for 4 weeks. I flunked out of that. Couldn't even do it for 4 weeks. And so I actually made it to the second 4 weeks of summer school that year. And I did that mainly because my grandfather was a principal and a school teacher, and his heart was broken that I had flunked out of high school. I was his only granddaughter, and he had big plans for me. I just didn't have the same plans. But anyway, so I got my degree, and didn't care anything about going to college. That was not for me. I was done with school. anyway, so I'm living with this man, and life is great, you know. He worked and said I didn't have to, and so that was great. I played Susie Homemaker. I started babysitting. It was something I had done through high school with being my mom being a single parent. You know, when it got time for cars and prom dresses and class rings and stuff, I had to help because there wasn't a lot of extra money. So I babysat. That was what I did. So I started babysitting kids. And at one time, I had 7 children that I was keeping while I was with this guy. And we got married. We lived together for a year, and then we got married. And the drinking started. And we would stay up all night long and drink a bottle of tequila, and we would go to sleep maybe at 3 or 4 in the morning, and he would get up and go to work at 7, and these 7 kids would come to my house, and I would keep these 7 kids all day. I look at that now, and I don't know how the hell I did that, because I can't imagine. But and the parents, that's what I think about the most, is those parents that were trusting their children to me anyway. Most of them were family, and they knew what was going on. But anyway, so I stayed. We ended up fighting, and it was on again, off again, and there was lots of broken glass, lots of dented refrigerators, just lots of chaos. So we decided it would be a good idea to sell everything we own and start driving a truck. So I went on the road with my husband, and I learned how to drive an 18-wheeler. And as long as we were driving that 18-wheeler, we didn't drink and we didn't smoke pot, so it was good. We stayed gone for like 2 or 3 months at a time, and then we would come home for a month. And we made a lot of money during that time. My ex-husband didn't believe in keeping a job for very long. So we didn't do that for very long, and we came home, and things just kept getting worse and worse, and we would drink, and then we would say we weren't going to, and we had a really nice house in Murfreesboro, and I was babysitting, and I woke up one morning, and I was having some pain in my female area, and I went to the doctor, and the doctor told me I was pregnant. And that was one of the happiest days of my life. That's what I had always wanted. I've always kept kids from 12 years old on. I'd always wanted a house full of them. I used to say I wanted to own my own daycare. And but the pain wasn't right, and we knew something was wrong. Within 24 hours, I was in the hospital having emergency surgery. I had ruptured my, and I was bleeding to death on the inside. And the doctor that saved my life, when I woke up, I said, I didn't, of course, understand what had happened, you know, because I'm just coming out of surgery. And he looks at me, and I'm all bright-eyed and hopeful, and he says, I bet you $1 million you'll never have children. And I held a huge resentment to that man for a very, very long time. I commenced to drinking like, and I didn't get all this then, and I didn't understand all this then, but looking back on it now, I was pissed off at God. I was pissed off at that doctor. You know, all I'd ever wanted was to have children, and God wasn't going to let me have any kid children. I tried to prove God wrong, and I had some more female issues through the years and had some more surgeries, and had a doctor that said, okay, I think, you know, we can fix you up and you can have a child. And the day before I went into that surgery, I left my husband. And so here I am single, and he's telling me I can have kids, and I got no husband. So this goes on. We were living in Alabama, actually, when we separated, and I came back home. And immediately jumped into another relationship. And that one lasted for, I don't know, about 1.5 years. That was my magic time, was 1.5 years. And then it was something was going on, and there was fighting and there was drinking and there was next, you know, and that's the way I looked at it, because I wasn't, you know, I picked the same guy over and over again, and I thought that if I could fix them, and I didn't know, again, I didn't know all this. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me this. If I could fix them, then they would love me, and if they loved me, then I could surely love me. I did end up getting pregnant again, and immediately lost the baby, and you know, again, I was just pissed off at God, and I started drinking more and more and more and more and more and harder and harder and harder. And to me, having a child was the ultimate form. I mean, that was what women are put here for. So if he wouldn't let me have a kid, then am I not worth anything? And that's what I thought for a lot of years. You know, if I wasn't worthy to be a mother, then what was I worthy of? You know, I wasn't worthy of anything. That's what I thought in my head. And I continued to drink and drink and drink. And life got more and more unmanageable. I was asked to put some juice into the story. I had a request, you know. And I don't want to stay long on a drunk-a-log, but, you know, I had no idea. I was totally delusional. I had no idea that what I was doing, there was anything wrong with it. I would stay out till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I would go to people's houses I didn't know, and I was in a blackout. I would come home. I didn't have shoes. I went to work one morning with no shoes, in the same clothes I had on the day before, and I thought this was okay, you know. By this time, I was working. I know, right? I was working at a machine shop. I had just met my second husband. We met in May, and we got married on New Year's Eve. 6 months sounded like the right thing to do. 2 weeks before we got married, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. He was a crack cocaine addict. I left that out. I didn't know what crack cocaine was. I drank and I messed with some pills and some marijuana, but I didn't know what crack was. That was out of my scope. But he had been clean. He had been clean for 6 months, and he had done it on his own. And we got married, and he got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and love was going to save the day. You know, my mom said, you don't have to do this. And she said, I said to her, have you read wedding vows? Do you know what they say? Through sickness and health, till death do us part. Well, that's not what happened. we got married, and within 4 months of us getting married, he relapsed, and he stayed gone all one weekend. He went on a weekend-long relapse. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know about alcoholism. I didn't know about addiction. I didn't know. He went to rehab. Well, let's see. I guess that was in April, and he didn't go to rehab until Thanksgiving Day. I drove him to Oklahoma to rehab, and he was supposed to stay for 30 days, and he missed me so bad, he had to come home right after Christmas. Aw. Come on, honey. You know, it'll be okay. We'll get through this. And I used to tell him that if you love me enough, you'll quit. If you love me enough, you won't go back to crack. You know, and there came a point, and we had some good times. I'm not gonna stand here and make it all bad. We had some good times. We had a lot of good friends. It was all partying, though. I mean, we used to go to Printer's Alley, and it was nothing for us to spend $500 or $600 in a night. I'm still paying credit cards from then, because we charged it. It was instant gratification. If we wanted it, we got it. He was a mama's boy, and if he said he wanted something, mama got it. If mama didn't get it, Marcia got it. I bought him a motorcycle for his birthday 1 year. And again, it was all about if I could be that perfect wife, and if I could make him love me, he would stay away from those drugs. We could drink all we wanted to, just leave the drugs out of it. Like I said, by this time I'm working at a machine shop. I stayed there for 10 years. I started out just answering the phones. I ended up managing the place. I went in the final days of me working there. It was crazy that man let me. I was doing his profit and loss month-end statements. I was managing his business. I was paying his bills. I had full run of his checking account, and I was a drunk. I was a flat-out drunk. It didn't hurt that he was too. We would leave for lunch and go have a glass of wine because we needed to talk away from the office, and we never go back. I got divorced from Jeff during that time. I immediately, when I saw, I told him Jeff was the crack addict. I told him if I was going to feel like I was single because of his drug use and his traveling and staying gone, if I was going to feel single, I was going to act single. And that's when I discovered the bars. We lived in Hermitage. I would get off the phone with him at night and say, yeah, I'm in for the night. And I would make sure my dog barked so he could hear her. And as soon as we'd hang up the phone, I'd be going to Levi and Hank's or Double E, and I'd stay until they closed. It was just, it got worse and worse and worse. And like I said, I would go home with people I didn't know. It's a wonder I wasn't raped or killed or cut into bits and put down a garbage disposal. I think of the danger that I put myself now in, and it's crazy. I would wake up, I'd lose shoes, I'd lose bras, I'd lose car keys, not know how I got home, not know if my car was in the driveway. Not know who or what I had done the night before. I was a blackout drunk, and I didn't like to sit still. Once I had enough to drink and a place got boring, I was a bar fly. And once it got boring, I was off to the next one. I thought it was smart that I had hidden a key in my purse, and I knew all the bartenders and all the bar owners, because I found out real quick that if I would help them close at night, I could stay in there and drink after the place closed. And I had a lot of good friends, but they would say, no, we're taking your keys away. Okay, here, you can have them. And then I'd be out the door because I had a hidden key in my car, in my purse. I had one in my purse and one in my car. I didn't listen to anybody. I didn't think I had a problem. I used to say I like to party hard, but I work hard too. I'm a functioning alcoholic. I look back now and laugh, and there was nothing functioning about me. I did all the crazy that we all do, I think. Jeff and I got a divorce. I immediately had somebody standing in the wings waiting. That didn't work. Again, I had picked the same guy. And the whole time I'm just going more downhill, more downhill, more downhill. I got fired from that job. I worked there 10 years and he let me go. He said it was because of money problems. He had to do cutbacks. And I look back, and I've had the opportunity since to thank him, because it speeded my bottom up. I decided that if I was going to be at the bar every night, I might as well work there. You know, if I'm going to hang out there, spend money there, why not make some money there? So my girlfriend, Marcia, owned the bar. Levi and Hanks, and I went and said, okay, I want to do something different. You know, my mom and my brother are going, oh my God, no, this is not going to be pretty. And I said, no, y'all, I know what I'm doing. I know it. I've sat behind a desk for so long, it's time for me to do some physical labor. It'll make me feel better. So needless to say, I started drinking during the day. I would, my shift was, I think it was 10:30 or 11 until 7 at night. So, and then I would get off work. So I would get off work at 7. I would get on the other side of the bar. I would sit there and drink till 3 or 4. I would close the place down, help them clean up, have to come back at 11. I had customers that gave me Loratabs as tips. So that was my hangover medicine. That took a hangover away just like that. A cheese sandwich, a glass of milk. I had a routine, you know. I wouldn't drink until 5 o'clock. That was my deal. I wouldn't drink until 5 o'clock. But I had this customer that started coming in every day, and he would say, let me buy you a shot. Well, by the end of my 8-month stint as a bartender, I was drinking at noon, and I found that it helped. It helped the night before. I ended up kind of getting fired from there because I was drunk as crap behind the bar on a busy, busy Saturday night, and I'm staggering around, and the boss looked at me and said, you're drunk. I said, but you gave me the shots. I wanted to blame somebody else. So, of course, she asked me to leave, and I did. I just kept going downhill from there. I started working for another man that used to own part of the machine shop, and I've rented an apartment from him, and I worked for him, so I had no consequences. He took my rent out of my check. If I laid out of work 3 days a week and I couldn't pay my rent, he'd say, oh, we'll make it up next time. So I had no consequences. I drove around in blackouts. I didn't get DUIs. I started there at the end. I started wrecking cars, backing into stuff, having a dent, not knowing where it came from. But as far as consequences, I really didn't have a whole lot. I did get a DUI, but it was like back in 2003 or 4, you know, and again, it was not much of a consequence. I paid $1,500. I did some DUI school in Kentucky and transferred some license around for a while, went without a license for 9 months, and I was scot-free. No SR-22. I was lucky. So I didn't think anything bad would happen to me. I was lucky. I'd always fallen on my feet. My bar of what was acceptable kept going down further and further and further. I lost every bit of moral thread that I had. It got to the end where it didn't matter what I had to do to get a drink. I wasn't so much into drugs. I wouldn't say no if I was drunk. But my love was rum. That was my thing, was rum. At the end, it got to be vodka, straight out of the jar. I mean, out of the bottle. The guy I was dating at the time, I was always scared he was going to drink more than me, and he drank like me. And he's a career criminal, probably still in jail today, but he lived in his mama's basement, and I thought that was cool. We were going to get married, and I was going to move in mom's basement with him. but I used to mark the vodka bottles, the bottles, whether it was vodka or rum or whatever it was. I would mark it, and I would say, okay, this is my last drink, and I'm going to make sure that some bitch don't drink any more than me. And I would mark the bottle, and I would go to bed. And I would lay there for a few minutes, and I would think, no, just one more. And I'd get up, and I'd drink another one, and I'd mark the bottle. And I'd get up the next morning, and I had this bottle with all these black lines all the way down, and there's this much in the bottom of it, if that, you know. But that was what I did. I was so worried that somebody was going to take my alcohol. Somebody was going to get more than me. And it was just crazy and chaotic, just total chaos. When I worked for the machine shop, and a lot of you know this part of the story, Well, my boyfriend went to jail. Let me back up. And two of my friends, I had been especially bad one night, and two of my friends did an intervention. And they said, you can stop now, willingly, or else. You know, we love you. We're not willing to find you in a body bag or put you in a body bag, and that's where you're headed. I said, I don't know if you need to go to some kind of meetings. I don't know what you need to do, but you're going to quit. I thought, okay, whatever. So I quit for, bless you. I quit drinking for 36 days. I didn't quit the pot, but I quit drinking for 36 days. And during that 36 days, I had made a contact at the machine shop, Jim Ellis, and he made a smart comment about me smoking, and I had been talking to Jim for like 5 or 6 years. We had bought sheet metal parts from the company that he worked for. My company bought stuff from his company, and we were each other's point of contact. So we had built this, it was a very business relationship. You know, we talked sometimes a lot during the week, depending on how much work we had going on, but we never got very personal. He didn't know a whole lot about me, and I didn't know a whole lot about him. But I was talking to him. I had used him as the company he worked for to make some parts for the new place that I was working. And he made a comment about me smoking, and I said, man, are you kidding? I said, I've given up alcohol. I said, gotta have something. He said, oh, really? And he immediately started telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me how much fun they have, and all these meetings, and the roundup, and all these people come from everywhere. And I hung up the phone going, oh my God, that man's crazy. First of all, I was surprised that he had had a problem. And he told me how many years he had, and I was like, well, why do you still go to those meetings? And he said, I'll never forget it, he said, so I can give back what was given to me. And so I quit for 36 days and thought I deserved a glass of wine. Glass turned into 3 bottles. I missed work for 3 days. And I continued to drink for 7 months, and it got really, really, really bad. My bottom, I've talked too much about this, my bottom was a car wreck. I woke up with a car that was completely totaled in somebody's front yard. I didn't remember getting behind the wheel. Don't know how I got there. Don't know how it got there. Something inside of me snapped at that moment. I didn't want to quit drinking, but I knew I was going to die. And I said, God help me. I called my girlfriend to come get me. I proceeded to cuss her out. That's what I did. I got drunk and I cussed out the people I love. I don't know how many nights I called my mom at 3 or 4 o'clock and, will you please come get me? I can't drive. And then I'd get in the car and I'd tell her my whole shitty life was her fault. Or I'd tell my brother, my whole shitty life is your fault. And I blamed everybody else. I couldn't look at myself. So, I knew something had to give. I didn't want to die. I wanted to die, but I didn't. Evidently, there was enough of me that didn't want to die, that part one, thank God. My mom came and got me. She sobered me up over the weekend. I stayed at her house. I was scared to go back home. I left the scene of the accident. They towed my car. That was on a Saturday morning that they towed my car. I spent Saturday night with mom. I went home on Sunday. I told my mom I want to go to rehab. She said, here's some places. You might want to call them. And I was mortified. Oh, my God, I have to do this myself. She had realized that she had been taking care of me. So I had to find a rehab. I stayed on the phone most of the day Monday. I could not find anywhere. I didn't have insurance. I didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of. I didn't have a job. I had a job, but it just paid my rent and gave me a little bit of spending money. But I didn't. It was no insurance and nothing very stable. So I kept calling and kept calling, and everybody wanted insurance. People wanted $30,000, and, you know, and I didn't have it. And I remember praying, God, what do you want me to do? I know I'm going to die. What do you want me to do? Please take care of this. First time, probably in a very long time, that I had been willing to ask for some kind of help from anybody or anything. My phone rang right after I said that prayer, and I had called a place early in the morning that I had forgotten. I'd even left a message, and they said, we have a bed available, but it's not available for until 7 days from now. And I said, I was bawling. I said, what am I going to do? I'm going to die between now and 7 days. She said, go to as many AA meetings as you possibly can. And Jim Ellis's words clicked in my head like a light bulb. And I said, okay, I can do that. And we made arrangements, and it was a state-run facility. They were only going to charge me $100. I called Jim Ellis, and I said, okay, I'm ready. I need help. And we had a long conversation that night on the phone. I met him. That was on a Monday. I met him on Tuesday night at Shade Tree. He called on Tuesday afternoon, and he said, are you coming? I said, yeah. He said, are you scared? And I said, yeah. And he said, can you say, my name is Marcia, and I'm an alcoholic? And I said, I think I can. He met me out in front of the building at Shade Tree. He introduced me to my sponsor, and I never saw him again the rest of the meeting. I left that meeting with hope, more hope than I'd had in a long time. Had women throwing numbers at me, throwing books at me. And they were sincere, and they were happy. You know, I went home, and I told my landlord. I was just gushing all this stuff out. This is what they said to me, and this is what, and I don't remember what they said in the meeting. I have no idea. I remember keep coming back, and I remember, you know, get a sponsor. And I remember that I didn't have to worry about not drinking ever again. All I had to worry about was not drinking today, just make it through today. And I told my landlord that, and I'm bawling, and he starts bawling. He had been with me for a lot of years, and he had seen the destruction, and he had tried to help, but all he did was enable. So I started going to meetings. I went to 7 days worth of meetings, and I went to rehab, and I stayed at rehab for 14 days. I wanted to stay for more. I was scared. The rehab that I went to was in Kingsport, Tennessee, so it was just far enough away that I couldn't call my buddies and say, oh my God, I've made a mistake, please come get me. My mom drove me there. I got there. It was girls straight out of jail or needle junkies. They were talking about drugs I'd never heard of. My mom was gone, and I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? I don't belong here. All I do is drink too much. Needless to say, within 24 hours, I knew I was right where I needed to be. And thank God, God took the desire to drink from me. I've not had to relapse yet. I've not had the desire to drink. Y'all told me to do things like get a sponsor, go to meetings, do service work. I didn't know what any of that meant. Work the steps. I didn't know what the steps were. I came back from rehab, and I asked Kimberly to be my sponsor, and she's been my sponsor ever since. I told her one time, I said, I don't know without you what I'd do. Without you, I couldn't stay sober, and she laughed, and she said, no, honey. She said, without you, I couldn't stay sober. And I understand what she means today. There were lots of suggestions that were thrown out in the beginning that I didn't take. One of those was stay away from a relationship. Well, she's laughing. There's a lot of suggestions I didn't take, but this was the big one. This was the big one. So at 2 months sober, I promptly get me a boyfriend. I had been praying for a long time. I wasn't looking anymore. God, send me the man you want me to have. And he walked into the Freedom House. And, you know, we made it, you know, most of y'all know this. We made it for 3 years. And we chose different paths. And I did not think I would live through that breakup. I had always had alcohol. I had always had drugs. I had always had Next. And I didn't have any of that. I don't know how. Well, I say I don't know how. My sponsor tells me it's because I work a program. And I say it's because I have her, and she doesn't mind putting her foot in my ass when I need it. She tells me the truth. I made it through that breakup. I didn't know that I was as addicted to relationships as I was to alcohol. And I didn't understand what that year was all about, but I can stand here today and tell you that I know what that year is all about. It took me 4 years to get my year, but I got it. And it, you know, it's a time to understand yourself. It's a time to know who you are. We come in this program and we don't know, or I didn't know who I was. I didn't love myself. There's no way I could love another human being. You know, and thank God for that experience. The steps have changed my life. I didn't understand how they could fix money problems and how they could fix problems with my family and how they could fix employer problems. But every time I got through one, I got a little bit better. You know, one, step one, my life is powerless. I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable. You know, I knew when I got to the program that I was powerless over alcohol, but I didn't know what unmanageability meant. I didn't know that losing bras and going to work with no shoes was unmanageability, you know. Just a little, she says. You know, I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. I thought an alcoholic was somebody that lived under a bridge with nothing. You know, when I hit my first meeting, I had just totaled my car, but I still had somewhat of a job. I still had a roof over my head. My family hadn't completely disowned me. They were close, but, you know. I didn't know that drinking was my solution and not my problem. And today, I'm glad, you know, that first meeting I walked into, I remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, my life is over. Really, this is the best you could do with yourself? And I was pissed. You know, this is the best you could do, really, Marcia? And I know today that was the very best day of my life. That was when my life started. Step four, I was gonna talk about each one of the steps, but I don't have enough time, so I'm just gonna pick out a couple of things. Step four, I had a lot of trouble on my step four. I thought that because I had talked about everything that I had ever done and everything that had ever happened to me, that I didn't have anything to write down on paper. And I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. And I was at a meeting out at the lake. Did I see Mark P here earlier? I was at a meeting out at the lake, and I was having trouble, and I was getting irritable, restless, and discontented, and I'd call Kimberly, and I'd say, you wouldn't believe what's going on, blah, 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 blah. How's that step four coming, Marcia? Oh, yeah, then there's that. And I had heard a lot of stuff in the meetings about step fours, you know, and one thing I heard was, that if you're having trouble with step four, you need to go back and do step three, you know, that maybe you didn't do that step completely. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to try that. And in a women's meeting one night, I heard this girl say, you know, I had to have candles. I had to get myself in a serene spot to do step four. And, And I thought, okay, that's a good suggestion. And then I was out at that meeting. It was one of the picnics we used to have, and there was a meeting on step four, and I heard Mark P. say, just do it. Just do it. And so I went home that night, and I said, okay, by damned, I'm going to get this step four done, come hell or high water. And I'm going to go back, and I'm going to read step three. I love candles. I lit every candle in my house, turned all the lights off. Get down on my knees. I read step three, very serious, very intent. I couldn't see because it was dark, and I didn't know the third step prayer. So I put a candle down here, and I'm praying with one eye open and one eye closed. And I got through the third step prayer, and I was saying some more stuff on my own, and I had my eyes closed, and all of a sudden I'm like, it got brighter. My book was on fire. I'm not kidding. And I almost brought it tonight, and I thought, no, I'm not going to tell that story, but I am telling the story. It wasn't hilarious at the time. I was bawling. I was on my knees, and I was screaming, what does this mean? What are you trying to tell me? So I was very embarrassed, and I didn't tell my sponsor for a few days, and I finally got the guts to tell her what had happened, and that I'd almost burnt my book to shreds and burnt my house down. And I, you know, I told her pretty much similarly to just the way I told y'all. And she said, Marcia, I'm pretty sure I understand what God was trying to tell you. And I thought, oh, here we go. Here's my answer. She said, you don't put a paper next to an open flame. That's what God was trying to tell you. You know, and I say that, it is a funny story, but I say that because that's what I had done my whole entire life. I had tried to complicate and manage, and I always, it never worked, you know. I complicated everything I touched, and I was still doing it in the program. I got through my step four. Still have my book that has a few pages that are burned in it. It's kind of funny when I look at it. I wanted to have one of those aha moments on step when I did my step five, and I didn't. But one of my biggest resentments was my brother, and I was on the phone with him 2 months after I'd done my step five, and I hung up and I started crying, and I thought, I don't hate him anymore. And I knew it had worked. Step six, defects of character. I did that one so good the first time, my sponsor backed me up to do it again. Evidently, I didn't think I had any defects of character. So I was talking to her, and I thought I was zipping right along, and she's like, we're going to back up. So, you know, my ego was totally shot and deflated. My pride, not my ego maybe, but my pride. And, it kind of knocked me down a notch or two, which is exactly what I needed. And that's exactly what she's done this whole 5.5 years. She doesn't hesitate to tell me the truth. My whole life, people patted me on the head and told me everything was going to be okay. And I believed them. And it wasn't going to be okay. I have a woman and other women in my life today that tell me the truth. And if they see me about to burn my book and complicate my life, they don't have any problem walking up to me and saying, hey, girl. And I'm very grateful for that today. I didn't like women much when I got to this program, and today the women are the ones that saved my ass. I have more and better friends than I've ever had my whole entire life. I get to sponsor women today, and service work is, that part of service work is just totally awesome. These girls call me and they're telling me what's going on, and I'm like, it takes me, you know, it's just like, oh my God, you know. Today I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic, and I didn't ever think I would be one of those people that said that. But I know, first of all, I probably wouldn't even be alive. But if God hadn't have brought me to this program. I never would have known how to ask for help. I never would have known how to have a conversation with another human being and really care about what they said or what they were saying. I would have never learned how to love myself, and that was the biggest one. Today I love myself. I know now that all those relationships, it was because I was scared of being alone. I didn't trust that God was going to take care of me. And I know that today. I love this program, and I love all you people. And thank you, Yet Group, for asking me to speak. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Walter. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Marcia. Great story. Experience, strength, and hope, baby. That's what it's all about. We appreciate you. This is a great fact from Alcoholics Anonymous, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Hey, we still have a lot of food over there, so get some to-go plates or whatever and help us clean up when we're done.
Marcia, would you like to take us out?
Sure. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you work it.